Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 4th, 2011. Who needs a biometric self-locking alarmed credit card carrier? You do. That's who. Muggers of the world, beware, the digital wallet is upon us. That story is coming up. And beware the spouse who keeps secrets about where the money goes.
Maybe it's a little bit lying because you're hiding it from them. Because I do know that when I purchase a new bag, I do kind of feel guilty and I won't bring it out for a little while. And sometimes he won't notice.
Financial infidelity is more common than you think. And news bulletin, the McMansion is not dead. It's just more energy efficient.
It's more expensive, but you know what you're paying up front is for the soundness of the structure, for the greenness and the tightness of the building. You will hopefully recoup that through energy savings.
Those stories and more coming up here on Marketplace Money. But first, oh, wait a minute. We're talking about the iPhone again?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, it's big news.
Oh, right, of course. Because iPhone customers are getting another choice of carrier. Alert the media. No, wait. Okay, so for those of you who have not heard, the Verizon Wireless iPhone will hit stores this week. Marketplace's Janet Babin, for one, will be exploring them as an option because her phone is, well, old, like 2 years or something. So she went looking for the best way to make a decision about her next move.
My BlackBerry became the butt of jokes when I lost the plastic K key, but I knew I had to replace the phone when it started calling my friends, even when locked. At one point, Cliff Schumann told me I called him 9 times within like 5 minutes.
It was just like your phone was calling me by accident as it was like rocking around in your bag.
Really? It was locked. So which new phone to get? I had to at least consider the iPhone. But I kept thinking about Daily Show host Jon Stewart's iPhone rant.
Those of us in the iPhone community have sacrificed one thing for the ability to carry around every photograph we've ever taken. We have sacrificed the ability to make phone calls.
The calls do get dropped all the time.
That's iPhoneista loyalist Mehine Toumani. She told me, get an iPhone anyway.
I mean, who even talks on the phone anymore, you know? I mean, you know, we send text messages, we send emails.
Ending dropped calls on the iPhone might be as easy as switching carriers. Early reviews of the new Verizon iPhone say reception's much better than with AT&T. My friend Ayala Burley still has iPhone envy, but she had problems with AT&T and won't be waiting in line for a Verizon iPhone either.
I also don't like Verizon. I've been around the block with all of them, and, you know, at the end of the day, T-Mobile is, even though, you know, the service is not the strongest, it's, to me, it's worth the customer service.
I could stick with my current carrier, Sprint, and get a new HTC Evo handset. At the Sprint store, Evo user Bill Vogel couldn't stop raving about how fast it downloads video. And he says the apps you can buy for the Evo really impresses kids.
They don't care about the Apple market compared to the Android market. All the really cool stuff that they all want to play with is on the Android market.
Great. So I've waited so long that the iPhone isn't even hip anymore, and we haven't even started talking cost. Any smartphone but a BlackBerry will set me back about $200, and that doesn't even include monthly data and calling plans. My friend Cliff, the guy my BlackBerry loved to call, he has an iPhone, but he told me buy a basic phone and get unlimited Metro PCS service for about $40 a month.
Why are we paying so much money for what? It's like I really just wanted a phone. Instead, I checked the weather, I checked everything else, and the phone part doesn't work, and then it becomes too expensive. Do I really need all of that?
That is the question. How much smartphone do I really need? I still haven't decided. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace Money.
So here's something I did with my phone for the first time this week. I paid for my drink at Starbucks. Yes, I am just that technologically advanced. And I would absolutely love to be able to do that for most of my transactions. Goodbye credit cards, goodbye driver's license. I mean, I already got rid of the photos because they're on my phone, right? Well, our own Steve Hatton has been exploring these possibilities, and he joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
So how close are we to this walletless world?
Well, you know all those millions of Americans that use Mint.com to create budgets and manage their money?
Yep.
Well, Aaron Patzer invented it. In 2 years, he built it into a $170 million business. But there's one aspect of managing his money that Aaron says is still a royal pain in the, well, you know.
I'm sitting here uncomfortably in this interview with a big chunky wallet in my pocket.
It's 2011. Google's built a self-driving car. New freezers can send text messages to your cell phone if the meat's going bad. And Patzer wonders why the old-fashioned wallet still exists.
There's no reason that you need to carry around as many cards as you do just to have the information that's on a magnetic stripe. If you could do it in a very secure way, you could eliminate all of that. It'd be a much more comfortable world to live in.
Lots of us are already halfway there. We have smartphones. And think, if you started paying with your phone, it could automatically warn you when you're going to overdraw, even guide you to the best deals on soap. And all this technology already exists. A few weeks ago, I walked into the Cheeky Monkey, a toy store in Menlo Park, California. I needed party favors for my 7-year-old's birthday, and I was in a hurry.
So this is our tub of erasers. We leave them kind of all mixed together because the kids like to go on the treasure hunt.
Okay.
When it was my turn to pay, I reached for my phone. It has a little sticker on the back, and that sticker, made by a company called Bling Nation, has a chip in it that can basically replace my bank card.
Just tap it onto the little machine here, and then it automatically comes out of your account.
Startups like Bling and Isis, which was founded by the nation's biggest wireless carriers, are gunning for the credit card companies. Visa and MasterCard charge merchants fees every time any customer swipes their plastic, and each year they make billions this way. The startup's plan is to undercut the big guys by charging merchants less in swipe fees, and they'll use chips on your cell phone or inside it to replace your plastic. Before any of these systems will work, though, stores will have to equip their cash registers with new gadgets that can read the chips. Jeffrey Mullins runs Dynamics, Inc., another startup that wants to digitize your wallet.
It would cost hundreds of billions of dollars to change the magnetic stripe infrastructure in the United States and re-educate the merchants that use it.
In the meantime, Mullins is taking a different approach. Instead of trying to build a credit card into your phone, he's building tiny computers inside traditional plastic cards. One smart card from Dynamics lets you choose among your different accounts, or...
For the loyalty-oriented consumer, Citi just announced the Prestige 2G card, which has two buttons. One button to pay for your purchase with credit, and for the first time ever, now you have the ability to pay for your purchase at the point of sale with your reward points.
And no matter what technology takes off, whether it's computerized credit cards or smartphones that can pay your tab, chances are it will be intelligent enough to steer you away from high credit card fees.
That's the problem we want to be solving. How do I get something in my phone that says, don't use this card, use this other card?
Omar Green runs mobile strategy at Intuit, the company that bought Mint.
There are potentials for us creating really, really smart systems that are smarter about your money than you are.
That potential hasn't been realized yet. Back at the Cheeky Monkey, after waiting and waiting for my charges to clear on my phone.
Why don't I go ahead and pay with a old-fashioned plastic card?
Or maybe I could even use cash.
Cash? No, Steve, don't do it.
Well, you know, we'll see, Tess.
Okay, well, let me ask a quick follow-up. I am particularly interested in what Omar Green said about our smartphones helping us manage our money.
Yeah, and the idea that they could be even smarter with our money than we are.
Right.
I mean, admittedly, that's a low bar, but there's some really...
Speak for yourself.
There's some really intriguing things phones could do. I was talking to Michael Abbott. He's the CEO of Isis, the company that's been set up by the telecom companies to do this stuff. And he was talking about how when you go to the checkout counter, you reach into your wallet, you get your credit card, you slide the card. Then when you're done with all of that, they give you a receipt that you have to file away. Well, you know, he envisions a world where all of that is just done automatically on your phone. And honestly, Tess, that is just the beginning. I was talking to a scientist. You may remember this, Oren Antezini, and he modeled airline prices.
Yeah. You got a lot of reaction to that story.
Yeah. People like Oren are also making models of other kinds of consumer goods. So you can imagine walking up to the counter and you're about to purchase, you know, a DVD player and your phone says, yeah, you know what? You're better off if you wait a couple weeks on this one.
That sounds absolutely awesome.
Yes. So there are tons of opportunities here.
Crystal balls is actually going to happen at some point?
Well, the thing I'm watching for is, and this is kind of a cliche, is the iPhone 5. Hmm. Apple has this incredible history of coming into a marketplace and offering a solution. And I think there's an opportunity for them to come in and offer a payment system, build those chips into the next generation of the iPhone, process those payments through iTunes, and create really cheap, reliable systems for merchants to install in their stores where that would work. So we'll see.
Maybe they could actually do that in their own stores so you don't have to wait in line for 2 hours to get the phone?
Well, you know, they have those really cool iPhone checkouts, right? You've seen those.
Yes, but they don't come down the line around the block to help you out with that.
No, that's true.
I know from personal experience.
It's a nice problem to have, though.
It certainly is. Thanks so much, Steve.
Sure thing.
All right, so Steve says the digital wallet is still a ways off. That's kind of good news for us, given that we have a new weekly segment peeping into people's real wallets all over the country. So what is in your wallet?
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
I am Sandy Sable. I am from Rim Rock, Arizona. I am at Oakland Farmers Market, downtown Old Town. My wallet is a black Liz Claiborne. It opens with little clips, and it has three compartments to it. And it's full of all kinds of good stuff. I have credit cards, and I have receipts, and I have money, and I have a list of things that I need to buy from the farmers market. And I have it marked off on what I did find: onions, fresh ginger, parsley, lettuce, chives. And then I've got to go somewhere else and find the other things. I have pictures of my grandbabies. I have four girls, which I call my grandgirls, and my one grandson that we call the boy. And he is 6 months old now. He's a beautiful little baby with great big blue eyes, just like me. My good memories are right here in this little part, and it's pictures of my granddaughters in San Francisco. And then this is a dear, dear, dear friend of mine that just died this last year. She was my best friend's mother. Beautiful, beautiful lady inside and out. If I could have anything in my wallet, it would probably be the pictures I have copies of, which are very important to me, but I guess the driver's license, because I've lost that before. But I guess there's really nothing that I can't do without in my wallet.
And this week's wallet was pried open by Janae Darden. One of the elements of healthcare reform that's already underway is the requirement that insurance companies cover kids with pre-existing conditions. California created an open enrollment period for parents to buy those policies, but the state is struggling to get them to sign up. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins went to find out why.
Nearly 5 million children in this country have pre-existing conditions that can make health coverage too expensive or impossible to get. One of those kids is Layla Wilkerson. She lives in Southern California.
What? Hold my hand. You're in the parking lot.
Layla's 4 years old. She's got long brunette ringlets, and she loves her gymnastics class, especially
going inside squishy blocks. But there's a giant inside them.
Who told you that?
That's Layla's mom, Maggie Wilkerson. Layla's healthy. There's just one thing.
I remember when she was 5 months old, she was laying on my chest and she had her head to the side, and I kind of noticed a bulge on the back of her neck.
So she took her daughter to a pediatrician.
And they discovered that it was something called a hemangioma.
A hemangioma is a non-cancerous growth. It can be dangerous, but doctors said Layla's wasn't.
So it was just simply a cosmetic thing.
At the time, the family had insurance, but Wilkerson's husband had been laid off. So when the insurance ran out, Wilkerson and her husband decided to remain uninsured and buy an individual policy for their daughter. But hemangioma was on a list of pre-existing conditions.
I can't tell you how many people I spoke with, and I assured them. I said, this is not something that interferes with her physically, but it was on the list. No insurance. That's it.
Under healthcare reform, insurance companies can't turn away children because of pre-existing conditions, but premiums can be high. To boost the number of insured kids, California created special enrollment periods when premiums are capped for sick kids and often discounted for healthy ones. The idea is to attract enough healthy kids to cover the cost of the sick. Patrick Johnston is president of an insurance trade association in California.
The system can be gamed if people jump in and out at will. And so it is better for everyone that people buy annually and have open enrollment periods.
In California, which could become a model for other states, the enrollment period has been open for over a month. But many people have yet to sign up. State budgets are so tight, officials can't completely afford to get the word out.
Unfortunately, there's some state outreach programs that were cut.
Kelly Hardy is with the advocacy group Children Now.
So parents may not know just because they may not have ever heard of the open enrollment periods.
Maggie Wilkerson didn't know about it, but she says even if she had, the price is still too high.
I can't do it. I will not do it. I'll deal with paying for her cash when she needs to be seen, but I'm not going to give an insurance company $600 or $700 monthly.
1 year, Layla's checkups and a visit or two to the emergency room cost the family more than $6,000. Wilkerson was eventually able to get her daughter insured through a nonprofit plan, but at the time, she and her husband had little income. Now they're self-employed, although still uninsured, and they may soon earn too much to qualify for Layla's policy. That would force them to choose once again between the certainty of high premiums and the risk of paying cash. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
And now for a segment we'll call Talk to Marketplace Money, and we'll make sure that by the end you want a divorce attorney. It's about financial infidelity, specifically spouses who hide purchases from each other. And before you judge people, bear in mind that a recent survey from an outfit called CESI Debt Solutions found 80% of married respondents said they do this. Now, you'd think no one in their right mind would want to talk on national radio about it. But you'd be wrong.
Okay, so this is our joint closet. However, my husband only comes on this side, and I come way back in here, so I do a lot of my hiding my stuff back here.
That is 40-year-old Mary Barnes of Redondo Beach, California. And she was taking us on a tour of hidden purchases in a medium-sized closet that she shares with 44-year-old Chris, her husband of 8 years. He works in the pharmaceutical industry. She teaches preschool. They have two kids. Mary is whispering a little because Chris is right downstairs.
But I was just at my favorite store over Christmas, and I haven't even pulled it out. But I have some stuff here. So this stuff I haven't even brought out yet.
And she had a shopping bag of workout clothes in one hand. And then Mary pulled out a box that seemed like it would be hard to miss in such a tight space.
Well, I got it before my husband got home. The clothes were up high, so he didn't see it. Honestly, I'm not really sure why this happens. I guess because things that I feel are important to me, he doesn't necessarily feel are important, and that we could spend that money somewhere else.
How much spending are we talking about here? About $300 worth. She received that money as a Christmas gift, but still felt compelled to hide the purchases she'd made with it. She says she feels judged and guilty. But surely Chris isn't totally unaware that this is happening, right?
I don't know if she actively hides them. It's more like they're hidden in plain sight. You know what I mean?
Indeed we do. But let's hear that one more time and let him finish the thought.
I don't know if she actively hides them. It's more like they're hidden in plain sight. You know what I mean? And my purchases are too.
Wait, what? Yes, he hides purchases too. Music, mostly.
I don't think we lie to each other. We just don't actively tell each other. Don't ask, don't tell.
Yes, but
household.
That's been repealed.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. I got to get with the times.
Maybe it's a little bit lying because you're hiding it from him.
Actually, no, there isn't a distinction. Lying and withholding the truth. But I think intent here is very important.
That's Victoria Collins. She's a psychologist who specializes in money and relationships. And we asked her to help explain why people who love and trust each other enough to get married would keep such seemingly trivial secrets.
Part of the reason we don't want to tell our spouse about spending is that we don't want to feel like a child again.
In other words, we don't want a spouse questioning every dollar we spend or making judgments about what we buy. We're adults, right? Collins also says some of the shopping guilt is self-created based on what kind of spending culture we grew up with. And in fact, Mary had an epiphany about her spendthrift father, who just might also be a factor in her squirreling away of packages. So let's hear what happens when we bring Chris and Mary back together in their condo.
All right, well, we are all back upstairs. I suppose this would be my Oprah moment. So what I gather from my conversations with each of you separately is Mary feels guilty when she makes purchases that she thinks you might not approve of, so she hides them. And, you know, what we understand from you, Chris, is that you really wouldn't care. So
that's true.
Tell me what's going on here.
You really don't care?
Obviously, lack of communication. I really don't, because I trust you enough to know you're going to make the right decisions.
I guess maybe sometimes the reason why I hide it is because I already have something similar, and then I'll buy something that's very similar. And
Five million jeans.
Okay, I hear some judgment in there.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know. That's a good point. This is a reckoning.
How can you not?
I don't think I do that. Because usually I'll notice something that's new and just not say anything.
Really? You know, you do?
Yeah. Don't think I don't see the Lucy box in the closet when I come home to put my sheet.
Now, we realize that one couple does not a representative sample make. So here's another marriage for us to tear asunder. Two blocks away.
Hello.
Hi, Mindy. Nice to meet you.
Mindy.
48-year-old Hollywood set designer Mindy Keith is another secret shopper.
So a lot of times, you know, I'll come in through the back and then I'll just throw it in my closet or it'll get hung up right away, you know.
For the most part, it's bags of clothes we're talking about, again. And why the sneaking around behind her husband's back?
He's never made any big deal about anything I've ever bought, but I almost feel bad just buying more stuff because he knows how much stuff I have.
She does have multiple closets full already, but says she does not need husband Ted's judgmental eye on those bags. And after 12 years of marriage?
I feel that if we both work, we're both entitled to buy whatever we want, as long as it doesn't put the family in a crisis. I don't feel like I have to tell my husband everything I buy.
And one thing we haven't mentioned yet, our couples both use the yours, mine, and ours approach to bank accounts, so they separate their money, yet still deal with issues of guilt and perceived disapproval. And according to Ted Keith, it is all perceived, not real.
She works hard. I don't want to give her grief over that. So I think she thinks that I'd be a lot madder than I am.
And in fact, Ted has engaged in this behavior as well. He once parked a newly purchased car at a neighbor's house for months before fessing up and bringing it home, a car he bought with his own money. Our money psychologist Victoria Collins says there is a solution to all this financial infidelity. Just talk.
One of the things that might be helpful to couples like this is to schedule a time each week and set a business meeting, a financial date night. During this one-hour period of time, each one can say anything they want, and there's no blame.
As we left Chris and Mary Barnes' house, I wondered if that might be a starting point for them.
So what are you going to talk about at the dinner table tonight?
Probably very uncomfortably quiet.
Funny how I don't remember them thanking us for coming.
Love and marriage, go together like a horse and
carriage. Of course, I'm kidding about the thank yous. It's all good. They were great sports. But while we're on the subject of thanks, have you at all noticed that one of the silver linings of the Great Recession is that suddenly businesses realize they shouldn't take you for granted. And just maybe it'd be nice to thank you for your patronage? Sally Herships noticed.
Sarah Seward is 24. She lives in Chicago. A couple of months ago, she hit a department store with her mom and her sister. They were shopping for purses.
And as soon as we got there into the purse section, one of the saleswomen immediately approached us and was really attentive. She pulled purses from the back. She went through different options, different colors.
Typical shopping experience, right? As long as you get an attentive salesperson, like Sarah did. She and her mom ended up buying a purse apiece. Then, a couple weeks later, they both got letters in the mail from the saleswoman who'd helped them. They were thank you notes.
It was a fully handwritten note referencing the exact bag we purchased. And on my note, she even had a nice reference to our alma mater.
Turns out they'd gone to the same school. And I'll admit, the purse Sarah bought wasn't exactly cheap. It was Marc Jacobs, about $400. But it's not just pricey department stores that are beefing up their manners. When the recession hit, JCPenney started a customer service program called GREAT. It's an acronym for salespeople. Greet, respect, engage, assist, and Think, and other retailers are following suit.
I've written at least 2,000 thank yous in just in the last 12 months.
Brett Broll owns Scrubadoo.com. He sells medical scrubs, you know, those pastel-colored outfits doctors and nurses wear. Broll says he hand-writes a thank you note for every single customer. Scrubadoo is a new company, and Broll says there are a lot of websites out there selling the exact same products he does.
If you Google the word scrubs, we're not on the front page, we're not on the second page. And just like every other industry, right now, I mean, competition's tough, and with less people buying, it's even tougher.
Broll says a new company like his can't afford major marketing, like TV commercials. Instead, he says he's counting on thank you notes to help Scrubadoo stand out. So, is this the beginning of a new trend of exemplary customer service? Nancy Kane is a retail historian at Harvard. She says for smart businesses, it is.
We're returning to civility, courtesy, and a way of, you know, actually honoring customers that has seemed far too absent, I think, for the last 20 years.
Kane says the role of the salesperson has changed a lot over the decades. Before the recession, a salesperson's job had morphed into managing transactions, bagging groceries, dispensing coffee, ringing up a sale. She says the more we've absorbed technology, like self-service checkout at the grocery store, the more retail businesses have reduced service. Now, the role of the salesperson is changing again. I'm at a perfume counter at Saks Fifth Avenue with James McLaughlin. He works for a fragrance company called Jo Malone. McLaughlin says its salespeople have been sending thank you notes for years. They're scented. But now, he says, the company spends 20% more time on expressing gratitude to customers, everything from hand and arm massages to wine tastings.
We oftentimes will liken this experience as like dating. You have a really great first date, and then the person calls you 3 months later when there's a sale going on and says, oh, how about a second date? And why would they bother? You didn't keep in touch.
But Chicago shopper Sarah Seward's salesperson did. Remember the one who sent her the thank you note after she and her mom bought purses? It worked. Seward says she just bought another bag. So, thank you for listening. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
And thank you so much for the report, Sally. Well, I think based on that, it is the perfect time to say thank you to our audience for listening and for sending us your thoughts about the show. So this week, producer Devin Robbins is here to help me sift through your letters and emails and Facebook posts. Hello, Devin.
Hi, Tess.
So what you got for us this week?
Well, our story about Karen Andrine of La Mesa, California, and her mortgage modification mess. It hit a real nerve with several of our listeners. Here's a reminder of what we heard on last week's show.
Every single month, we get something saying if we don't make our full payment plus all the late fees, that they will foreclose.
So you just never know when somebody might come walking
up. Right, but every month, the bank accepts our payments, our trial payments.
Because if they don't,
then we know to start packing our stuff.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that this story struck a bit of a chord with folks. It certainly did with me when she wrote in.
I know, and we got a slew of letters expressing sympathy. They also identified with her struggle. Brady Dresden of Walnut Grove, California writes, "The Andrine story is almost exactly what's been happening to him. He feels like he's being scammed by his own bank."
Wow.
And he thanked us for telling the story. Marsha Bryant of Cleveland, Ohio, had an extreme solution to the mortgage mod dilemma. She writes, "When I hear stories like this, I wonder why people just don't burn their houses down for the insurance. There is no motivation to try to do the right thing."
Yeah, that is extreme. Okay, so what else are people talking about and writing it about?
Well, several people wrote in to opine about your conversation last week with regular Money contributor Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch. You guys discussed how rapper 50 Cent, let me clear that up.
No, 50 Cent. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Tess. Was pitching and tweeting about a certain bedtime product.
Ouch, stubbed your toe in the middle of the night? Now there's Bright Feet, the high-tech house shoes that light up your night. Bright Feet.
All right, so Kathy reminded folks that it is not a good idea to take investing advice from Twitter.
Right, but she also didn't say anything about the product itself.
No.
So listener Charlotte Littell of Elizabeth City, North Carolina, she filled in the blanks for us.
I hate to tell you, but Bright Feet are wonderful. I've given them as gifts to new moms who have to get up at night to feed or check on the baby, and the elderly who have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. As an investment? Who knows?
You know, Malcolm Hegg of Rochester, New York says, actually, Al Bundy wore the first pair on Married with Children.
I smell royalties in the future somewhere. And I know we also have some responses to our new weekly wallet segment. Got some of that for us?
Yep. Nick Talantis of Traverse City, Michigan wants in on all the fun.
My wallet is a rubber band surrounding two credit cards, a debit card, and a driver's license with a very limited amount of cash.
And Steve Byrne of Berkeley, California, well, he chimed in on our Facebook page. He says his wallet contains Argentine pesos, three U.S. dollars, tons of receipts, and a six-month-old note from his girlfriend. It's very George Costanza, he writes.
All right, lots of fun. Thanks, Devin.
You're welcome, Tess.
And we want to hear from you about the show and how we're doing. Tweet me at Radio Tess, or post on our Facebook page, or go to marketplace.org/money. It is time once again for your questions. Helping us out is our good friend Liz Pulliam-Weston, personal finance columnist for MSN. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Tess.
How are you?
I'm great.
Well, let's talk about something that has been kind of creeping back up in the news, which is the notion of inflation. Now, last year we kept hearing that there were all kinds of risks of deflation. Now we're hearing, well, maybe actually there's more inflation than we think there is.
Here's the deal. We don't know from one minute to the next what's going on with the economy, and that's just the bottom line. We were worried about deflation because of, you know, there has been falling housing prices. That's a huge drag on the economy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's other areas, wages going down in certain areas, you know, that's pretty scary. When we think deflation, we think either the Great Depression or we think of Japan, which just, you know, was stagnant for so long.
So what happens if it becomes a concern? I mean, obviously higher prices, but you can't really do anything. So
actually, you can do a lot. And that's the thing. People get really creative. They start substituting. They stop buying certain things. They buy more of others. I always think having an emergency fund is a good idea. And inflation is not necessarily a bad thing for certain assets like real estate.
Or savings accounts.
Or savings accounts. It'd be nice to make a little money there, too. Yeah. So there's advantages and disadvantages.
Well, while we wait for things to either inflate or deflate, let's hit the phones. Aunt Teresa is with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there. How are you?
We're very well. Are you still digging out from the snow?
Oh, my gosh. It never ends. There's just no place to put it anymore. You know, you dig and the piles that you're throwing it in are taller than you are.
Yeah. I mean, I saw something on Twitter today where somebody was warning people that cars were pulling out from 8-foot drifts of snow. So you needed to really be careful with driving down the street that you didn't run into a car that was hidden and coming out into the road.
I've actually changed the route that I drive to my daughter's daycare because I used to drive on little streets that would pull out into big streets.
Uh-huh.
And it's just so hard to see. It's scary. So now I just stick to the big streets.
Wow, that's just incredible. So, all right, how can we help you out today?
As I said, I have a daughter I take to daycare. She'll be a year and 2 weeks.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you. She's wonderful. But as part of that, we've been looking at our financial picture and, you know, increasing our life insurance. And, you know, I hit this question that I couldn't answer. I don't know how to calculate my net worth. You know, I have property. Is it that you take away from what you owe on the mortgages when you have retirement plans?
Right.
Does the retirement count because you don't have access to it?
Great question. I think this is one of those basics that it's a very common question that people just don't know how to answer.
Well, and this one is actually pretty simple. It's your assets minus your liabilities. And yes, you do count everything. I mean, technically, your retirement funds are going to be beyond the reach of creditors if you get sued. But still, put that in the mix so that you know exactly what you own and subtract what you owe, and that's your net worth. And I presume you're asking about this because you need to get an umbrella liability policy because it's not really a factor in life insurance. Okay.
Yeah.
And personal liability policies, for those who don't know, it's kind of an umbrella policy that sits over your homeowners and your auto coverage that kicks in.
And we've talked about this before. You're an advocate of this.
Oh, huge. Because typically the maximum coverage, liability coverage you can get from your homeowners is, you know, maybe $500,000. If you are someone who is likely to get sued or it's even a possibility, that's probably not enough.
Yeah.
The general idea is you want liability coverage of at least your net worth, 2 times is better. And if you are in a position where you might be more likely to be sued, you might go up from there. So I would I'd talk to a couple of insurance agents about exactly what you need. What did your agent tell you?
They told me that I didn't have a net worth enough to make it worthwhile. Which made me think, huh, really? I guess I'm in the building phase, and so I don't have much on the books yet, but I also don't have that many liabilities other than, you know, again, do I estimate what the cost of my, what the value of my condo is and then take away the mortgage?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question, because particularly in a fluctuating housing market, you know, what, should she hire an appraiser and figure out what her house is worth, and then that's part of her net worth?
Oh, no, I wouldn't go that far. I would just look at comps. You could even go on Zillow. For a lot of areas, Zillow is close enough.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Liz and Tess. I appreciate the help.
Hey, anytime.
Thanks for the call.
All right. Take care.
All right. Next, we have Jennifer from Macon, Georgia. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
How are things there in Macon?
Very well. And you?
Very well. Thank you so much. So tell us what you do there.
I am a chemistry professor. I teach, and my students and I do research in green chemistry, making industrial processes more environmentally friendly.
Wow. So talk to us about green chemistry.
Everything that you buy pretty much involves chemical processes. Even something like a bottle of water, there's chemistry involved in making the plastics, in making the adhesive to hold the glue on. If we understand them in enough detail, we can find ways of making them just a little bit more energy efficient.
So what you're talking about is really using our resources differently.
Exactly.
Well, what can we help you out with today for your wallet?
My question has absolutely nothing to do with chemistry. I'm wondering if you could help direct me towards resources for helping adults learn finance basics.
You're looking to teach a class?
So my situation is that I am financially very fortunate, and I live in a neighborhood where a lot of people are not. In particular, one of my neighbors has constantly been coming by and asking me for money. $10 for gas one week, $20 to help with groceries next week. And she is always having financial emergencies so that she's never able to pay me back. She seems enthusiastic but overwhelmed when I try and talk to her about budgeting or savings. So I was wondering if there might be like a class I could direct her to on financial literacy or a bank program.
Well, Liz, your most recent book is the Ten Commandments.
Maybe I should add an 11th
money.
One. Thou shalt not a lender be.
Exactly. Yeah. So where does helping out a friend with a few bucks here and there fall?
This one's really tough. I mean, when you're dealing with a relative who constantly hits you up for money, there's a little bit more leverage there. You know, I've talked to people who had parents that were financially irresponsible, and, you know, they basically took the parent to a financial planner, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But there are some resources you can point her to if you want to. I'm just cautioning that it probably won't do much good. But with that, consumer credit counseling services are pretty well known for helping people with credit card debt. What they're less well known for is their budgeting classes. The oldest group is the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. It's nfcc.org. I don't know that just giving a book will help, but there's Personal Finance for Dummies. You know, there's a lot of basic personal finance books. But again, you know, if you're turning to a neighbor for $5 and $10, you know, I want to believe that financial literacy can help and change things. But if she's an older woman, she's been out there in the world for a while, you know, I'm not sure this will help.
What about the fact that she keeps helping this woman out? I mean, should Jennifer be having second thoughts about that?
This is really,
I guess it's really up to you, Jennifer. But
yeah, and I actually talked to the ethicist at the New York Times about this very, well, not this very issue. I was talking about panhandlers. And I was saying, should I be giving money to a panhandler when I'm pretty sure it's going to be used for alcohol or drugs? And he came back and saying, it's none of your business. If you choose to give the money, it's not your business what is done with it. All right. But it's kind of the same thing on this level. Are you enabling her? Absolutely. Is it any of your business? Well, maybe not. It's kind of up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep this up, I mean, it's entirely possible the amounts will get bigger. The next crisis will be more urgent. Ideally, she'd find a way to deal with her money herself. I just have a little bit of a dim view about whether she'll be able to do that.
Yeah. So, Jennifer, does that give you some starting points? What do you think you'll do from here
definitely.
On out?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's useful, and that I can kind of maybe find one of these classes and then tie, well, if you need more money, you have to come to this class with me or something like that.
Either that or you'll be done with her. One way or the other.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for the call, Jennifer. Good luck.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And finally, we have Eric from Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
How are things there in Iowa?
Very snowy, but not as much as in the Northeast right now.
So what do you do there when you're not shoveling snow?
I'm a cellist and a college professor.
Oh, fun. I played the cello in high school.
Did you really?
I did, indeed. I played many, many instruments in high school. I played cello, I played flute, I played the bells, and of course I played classical piano as well.
But. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's the one instrument that's, you know, heavier and more awkward than a cello.
Yes, yes. I can't carry that one around with me.
Are you also in a quartet, or do you play?
I have a cello-piano duo with my wife, who's a wonderful pianist and also teaches at the college that I teach at.
Oh, very cool.
All right, well, enough music geekdom.
Sure.
I could keep you on forever talking about this, but what can we help you out with today?
Yeah, my question was about how aggressively my children's 529 accounts should be. I have a son who's 5 and a daughter who's 2. Okay. And my wife and I talked about, you know, how aggressively we wanted to do it. Iowa's 529 is a Vanguard fund that offers 4 age-based tracks. You can also do, you know, you can micromanage it yourself. But knowing myself, I didn't want to do that because I would spend way too much time doing it and probably end up worse off anyway because I'd always be kind of reacting, you know, to the latest.
You know, that's a level of self-awareness I wish that 90% of investors yes. had. My goodness. Well, congratulations. Yes. Very good. Very
so
good.
You've got them in the age-based program then.
I do, and yeah. they offered, you know, track A, B, C, and D. And my wife and I spoke about which, you know, we should put our money into. So we opted for the third most aggressive out of 4.
So right in the middle, or right towards the aggressive edge?
No, towards the conservative
side. Oh, towards the conservative edge. Okay.
Yep. So I guess my question is, that's even too aggressive now that I've seen the stock market kind of kicking around in the same place for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't really think you have to worry about it because these kids have a cellist father and a concert pianist mother, so they're going to become musicians and get full rides, aren't they?
See, I guess, you know, I mean, I feel like my own retirement account is in one of these age-based kind of things.
Target date fund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I can delay retirement. Mm-hmm. But I'd be much less comfortable with delaying when I could send them to college, you know?
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. I think Eric came up with exactly the right comparison because with retirement, we do have more flexibility. With kids, you need the money when you need the money. Mm-hmm. I have the same concern about the age-weighted stuff that you do. I'm a little concerned that it's too aggressive too late in the game.
Hmm.
So what I am planning to do with my daughters, and this is just me, when she's a freshman in high school, I'm going to put her first year's college tuition into a money market. And then when she's a sophomore in high school, her second year's tuition, I just want that money in cash, safe and available when we're going to need it.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, you know, it's like I said, this is what I'm going to do. And a lot of people are comfortable with a little more risk than that. But we saw during the crash, a lot of these 529s were too aggressive and they stayed too aggressive.
Right.
And some people really got shellacked right when they need the money.
And for a lot of these plans, isn't it the case where you are only allowed to change your allocations once a year?
Yeah, I think we got the chance to change it twice during the worst of things. But that's still, you know, that's not a lot of time to react.
Right.
And these people really did need the cash and it was just gone. So I would err on the side of being a little more conservative. Make sure that if you're going to need the money within 5 years, that it's sitting there in cash.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you've got a question, our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That is 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz Weston, thanks so much for stopping by.
My pleasure.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. At the peak of the housing crisis, many industry watchers were officially declaring the era of the McMansion over.
Well, as the economy gradually shows signs of recovery, homebuyers appear to be saying that square footage has not lost its luster just yet. As Adam Allington reports from St. Louis Public Radio, a glut of cheap properties is keeping smaller, more energy-efficient houses on the market's fringe.
It seems like a long time ago already, but back in 2008, $4 a gallon gas had everyone looking to cut energy costs, including homeowners. It was during this time when Jay Swoboda had a big idea. Together with a group of investors, Swoboda formed EcoUrban, a modular home building company that designed and built small, energy-efficient homes, around 1,000 square feet. He says right away the feedback from focus groups was not encouraging.
1,600 square feet was about what the minimum that people wanted. They wanted 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, all on the same floor. And it was just impossible to actually meet that demand. So we were quickly educated away from our initial thought.
As gas prices fell back around $3 a gallon, Swoboda says buyers were still turned on by the idea of energy efficiency, but were not willing to sacrifice space to get there.
People are going for the square footage, hoping to do the energy efficiency improvements in the future. I don't see them actually doing them on the front end to kind of reduce that footprint up front.
Today, one out of every 13 houses sold is new construction. Still, despite the odds, many home builders are embracing energy efficiency and square footage, and they're doing it with a variety of next-generation technology.
Hey, how are you?
Hello.
Hi, I'm Adam.
Vihar, nice to meet you.
Vihar Sheth just moved into a platinum-certified LEED home in South St. Louis. At over 3,000 square feet, the house is big by any standard. But this is no McMansion.
Almost everything we picked was green. The exterior is a fiber cement, which is a recycled product. Windows are all super energy efficient. All the paint is no VOC, so there's no chemicals. All the cabinets are made locally with soy-based and water-based stains.
Sheth's house costs nearly twice as much as similar-sized properties on his block, but he's hoping that the upfront costs are worth it in the long run.
It's more expensive, but you know what you're paying up front is for the soundness of the structure, for the greenness, for the lack of thermal breaks and the tightness of the building. And so, you know, you will hopefully recoup that through energy savings.
That is precisely the attitude that home builders are hoping will gradually push energy efficiency into the mainstream. In the meantime, all those faux chateaus that seemed like such a bad idea at the peak of the housing crisis, well, they're still here.
There's been a lot of talk in the press that the McMansion is dead and consumers are now permanently wanting smaller homes, et cetera. There's nothing in our research that indicates that's the truth.
Stephen East tracks national home builders for Ticonderoga Securities. He says that by and large, home builders are not willing to trade upfront cost for long-term savings.
The sweet spot is anywhere from 2 to 5 years. If they can't see a legitimate payback in that time, they won't do it. They would much rather go toward the granite countertops. There's just not a big enough green push in the U.S. for people to pay out of their pocket for it.
Still, East does agree that as costs come down and building codes get tougher, energy efficiency will become the standard. And if you don't believe him, just ask Martha Stewart. The domestic trendsetter is collaborating with KB Home to offer a line of environmentally friendly houses, complete with solar panels, compost bins. There's even an option for an electric car charger. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, they say there's no romance without finance. So what's an unemployed single person to do?
Everybody at one point or another always asks that same question, what do you do for a living? And it's just been very tough for me to admit that right now I'm not working.
Okay, what is it with this program and its total lack of romance? Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.